Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 351 of the podcast. It's Saturday, 2nd of December, 2017, as I record this. And can you believe we are almost at the end of the year? And it was funny, yesterday I was doing some signing some documents. In fact, I was signing my updated will, which is hilarious because that's what we're talking about today. But as I was doing it, I was very aware of the year and I was like, got to get the year right, you know, because as you move into the new year, you have to start writing 2018. And it's kind of crazy. I think mainly because I started this, the Creative Pen in 2008. So I'm very aware that 2018 is my 10-year anniversary. Which is very weird. Anyway, today I'm talking with romance author M.L. Buckman about estate planning for authors and intellectual property rights and why you need to value what you create. And Matt is also fantastic on marketing, and we talk about what he calls ticking the reader clock, which I really like and I'm very much trying to organize in 2018. I think I've been much better with the podcast this year, but I'm also going to try and do that with my fiction and my YouTube channel. So we are going to get more serious about video. So that'll be interesting. So in publishing this week, very interesting email from Goodreads, which everyone is kind of freaking out about. Well, not freaking out, just going, what the hell? So Goodreads has been free to do giveaways for years. I think Goodreads was around, I think, when I started out. I mean, it really is very old. And then it got bought by Amazon a few years back and they've integrated it with the Kindle. So it is very powerful now in that obviously the data points, Amazon bought it for the data, and the data points must go into their algorithm in some way. They have quite interesting discoverability. I use the app on my phone to log my reading, and a lot of readers do. So I've been doing giveaways on Goodreads now, certainly all this year. I've been doing rolling giveaways sort of every week. I've been doing giveaways across my three author names. And the good thing is that some percentage of those people who enter the giveaway add the book to their want to read list. And that then becomes part of the discoverability engine, blah, blah, blah. So that's been free. And of course, you have to pay for the copy. So it's been costing me between like 10 to 20 pounds, depending on where the person is in the world. And I've kind of, you know, I've appreciated that. And certainly for my sweet romance name with my mum, we haven't had many other ways to do promotion because, you know, I'm just trying to do that in a way that is sustainable for that author name. So I'm not ploughing loads of money into it. So we've used Goodreads giveaways to try and get the word out. So Goodreads has emailed everyone and said they are now going to start charging. So the standard package will be $119, and their premium package will be $599. And this will be for print books or Kindle books, and it's only for people in America. So I don't think that's authors. It means the only people who can enter the giveaways program will be in America. Now, this to me seems very odd because one of the nice things is that you can specify different countries. So, for example, I've got on my shelf right now a couple of extra copies of End of Days, and I would like to give them away in the UK so I don't have to pay loads of shipping. So I can do that with the Goodreads giveaway. I can also email my list, which is what I'll probably do in the end. But I think it's pretty weird that they've limited this to US residents only. I don't know why they would have done that. But yeah, I think this is interesting because in one way, oh, they've got special introductory pricing. So two things. One, this doesn't happen until I think the 9th of January 2018. So if you get your Goodreads giveaways in before the January the 9th, it's still free. So go forth and schedule giveaways. And then between January the 9th and January 31st, 2018, you can get 50% off. So $59 for the standard and $299 for the premium. So this is really interesting. I may well try
maybe one of each or something, just to see what the impact is on the special deal. I do think $600 is incredibly expensive for a giveaway that you have to pay for. So it may be that they are, so, and it's not like BookBub where you can measure the return on investment because you don't necessarily get sales. You're more likely to get reviews. Now, traditional published authors use Goodreads to get out a lot of ARCs to readers and bloggers and create buzz. But indies don't have the budget to send out several thousand print books. That's just not something we're going to do. So I'm kind of interested in this. I think it may mean that a lot more traditionally published authors use it, and also, I mean, traditional publishers, not the authors, publishers, but also indies with more money, which I think is quite sad, because one of the best things is being able to use it as an indie who's just got started. And it's basically, you can get some reviews and you don't have to outlay too much. So I know there's a lot of people upset about this. I hope Goodreads is hearing the upset. Certainly, I think it's a bit of a shame that they've done this. But, you know, a lot of this promotional stuff is going the way of pay to play. So maybe this is just another one. So another really interesting thing this week in publishing, Publish Drive. Now, I've mentioned before that, so I'm gradually getting all my books on Publish Drive. I've got a whole load of fiction there at the moment to go to Google Play and loads of ebook stores that we don't have access to via other sites. But the fact that they've been, you know, they're a Hungarian company run by a group of millennial entrepreneurs. And I love that, because so much of publishing is run by older people, and so you know, we've seen in the last few weeks sites close when they've been bought by traditional publishers. So Pronoun, Type and Tell, you know, it's clear that the publishing business is struggling with the idea of digital and the idea of these kind of ebook services or helping author services. So Publish Drive has just closed a $1.2 million funding round because they're in a Google incubator. That's the word. They're in one of these business incubators, and they are also launching a US company. So they, you know, that's fantastic, because it means they're going to get a lot more help. They have reach to 400 plus stores and focus on the global market a lot. So it's very clear that this business believes in ebooks. And it's so funny, when I talked to Kinga Gentetics, who's the founder, who was one of the Forbes entrepreneurial women under 30 a couple of years ago. She's fantastic. And I was like, so, you know, you're thinking of getting into print? And her face was just like, why would I do that? You know, our focus is mobile, global, digital, and which is exactly what we're talking about. So I see the future of all of this in a company like Publish Drive. So don't get depressed about things like Pronoun or Type and Tell folding, because traditional publishers bought them and tried to force them into a business model that is not working. Whereas Publish Drive is like embracing the global digital mobile idea, and good on them. And they also are trying to integrate AI, machine learning, and natural language processing. So very excited about the things that they're going to do in the future. And just to be clear, I go direct to Amazon, Kobo Writing Life, and iBooks. And then I use Drafter Digital for Nook and some of the other ones Drafter Digital uses. And now Publish Drive. I've added Publish Drive to the mix. So yes, that is a very positive thing. And I do have a futurist article this week, because I've had a few comments about my sort of positive approach towards AI, the AI assistant. And of course, I definitely would not replace my wonderful virtual assistants that I have now. But interesting article on Wired.com this week with the headline, Welcome to the Era of the AI Coworker, which is exactly what I've been saying. So I'm just going to read a bit of it. So quote, we're not living in the golden age of AI, but we are living in the golden age of AI enhanced productivity. And what's interesting is they actually use translation as their example. Translators have long been on the front lines of AI induced job panic, and they aren't worried. In fact, some are delighted started. For those who've seized on the potential of AI tools, productivity has skyrocketed, along with the demand for their work. AI is now powerful enough to make a solid first attempt at countless complex tasks. The Washington Post's in-house AI, Heliograph, published 850 articles last year, with human reporters and editors adding analysis and colourful details. AI tools can generate first pass at designs, and in publishing, weed through slush piles, which is interesting. Translators using post-editing machine translation, PEMT, involves letting the machine take the first pass and then using a human translator to tidy up the language. So this is really interesting. It's a bit like how I use Dragon and most people use Dragon, which is first pass dictation, and then you do an edit yourself. And the website they talk about is translated.net, which currently serves over 100,000 customers, including some very big companies. So it's really interesting. They also say, quote, a technological leap will always bear holdouts. There will be people who can't stand the thought of collaborating with machines and who would rather bury their heads in the idea journals and pretend nothing is changing. For those workers, this AI growth spurt is nothing short of an existential crisis. End of quote. So I think this is a great article. If you're interested in this whole AI translation idea and also AI co-working, go check it out. Wired.com. Welcome to the era of the AI co-worker. And I will link to that in the show notes. Will you embrace working with AI? As we have all embraced working with computers, the internet, the smartphone, you're probably listening to this on a device. We use these tools as part of our work. And I think, AI is actually just a whole load of tools that are going to help us create more, which is exciting. So my personal update, I am still in the final phases of the three books I have coming out before New Year. Oh, the finishing energy. And it really is a bit of a grind to get through this, but I'm getting there. The Healthy Writer is now in print proof stage, so we hope to get the print pre-order up soon. The ARCs have gone out to those people quoted from the survey, and it is available in ebook pre-order and will be hopefully, as I say, the print pre-order in the next week or so, because I'm getting people emailing about that because I realise that so many people want to buy nonfiction in print these days. So really important to have that done. Map of Shadows is basically completely done now. It comes out 12th of December, which, oh my goodness, is that like, that's like next week. And the print and ebook pre-orders are up for that. I'm really, really grateful for pre-orders. It's so funny because, I mean, some people don't like pre-orders, and certainly on Amazon, they're not necessary, or maybe a short pre-order of like a week so you can get everything sorted, but with Kobo and iBooks, doing pre-orders is great. And in fact, BookBub did an article this week on using pre-orders and why they're so effective. I love them because you can get everything sorted and just focus on things like doing some marketing, and so I've been scheduling some ads. And this is the thing now, like when you do a launch in inverted commas, you can just schedule everything. And I'm actually going to do a blog post on scheduling and that type of thing. It will save you time, because that's another one of my big messages, I think, for 2018 is going to be batching. By batching, I'm going to be able to get so much more fiction done, which I'm really excited about because I have so many books I want to write. Also, The Third Sweet Romance is in the proofreading stage, so that will be done in ebook, print and large print in the next week or so. And it's so funny because I have told a number of people that I was going to wait a year to come out in inverted commas with the romance name, but I'm actually starting to record a whole load of videos for doing, building your author website. Those videos now are a couple of years old. Not that my process has changed, but I just want to update it. And I'm like, I really want to show the sweet romance author in that video because it's the perfect example of a new author website. You are not going to copy the Creative Pen at this point, but you could copy JF Pen or the sweet romance author. So watch this space. I will probably be revealing that in December as opposed to like April. So yes, we've got a much bigger project, which is trying to make the Creative Pen organized around pathways. So I'm thinking about pathways. So if you're a new fiction author, for example, what is your pathway to make a living with your writing? And if you are a non-fiction author, what is your pathway to make a living? And then also trying to reorganize our email lists really look at streamlining how to get through the information on the Creative Pen, because there is so much and a lot of it's very useful. It's just you can't find it. I will be updating the blueprint and making sure you can get it on BookFunnel. So if you've been on my list for years, I will be encouraging you to sign up again so you can go through the new system in the new year, and it will hopefully help you with where you are and everything. So okay, yes, and also I mentioned my 10-year anniversary next year in December 2018, but that makes this week my 9-year anniversary with the Creative Pen. Oh, it's funny because time goes fast and yet slowly at the same time. Very weird. Also, last weekend, I attended my friend Orna Ross's workshop on how to create a living and a life with your writing. And it was great. I had a chance to really reflect on a few things. And also Dr. Ewan Lawson, my co-writer for The Healthy Writer, we had our photos done for the back of the book and some of our promotional pictures. So we actually... This is only the second time we met. The first time we met was a year ago when Orna and I did a workshop that Ewan came on. And in that workshop, he decided to give up his PhD and write a book and then ended up pitching me on the book. And that's how we came to The Healthy Writer. And of course, he will be on the podcast. It will actually be the Christmas Day edition. Christmas Day is a podcast day. We have recorded it already, don't you worry. But The Healthy Writer is launching the week after Christmas. So you will be recovering from eating too much and you can listen to a healthy podcast. But what was interesting at the How to Create Anything Day with Orna, I'm sorry if you're listening, I can't remember your name. I didn't get your name at the time, but she was talking about the metaphor of a motorway. And I thought this was really interesting because she said that she's just starting out and she listens to the podcast and she feels that everything's so fast and she can't keep up with things. And I was kind of saying, well, it is like a motorway in that, sure, I'm probably in the fast lane, you know, a lot of the time I'm in the fast lane. And if you're trying to just get onto the motorway, maybe you're feeling like those people in the fast lane are going really fast, or maybe you're in the slower lane. You're on the motorway, but you're in the slower lane and you want to get into the next lane. So how do you get into the next lane? How do you take that next step up? And even though it might feel like I'm in the fast lane to some of you, I also feel like I'm in the slow lane of other things. So some of the people I'm listening to right now, some of the ideas that are challenging me are pulling me forward into a faster lane in some areas. And of course, my craft is where I still feel like, you know, I'm probably not in the approaching the motorway. I'm definitely on the motorway with my craft, but we can always be better at the craft. So I hope that metaphor is interesting for you. And of course, one of the rules is to get onto the motorway, you actually need to speed up. You can't slow down to merge onto a motorway lane. This metaphor might be completely useless in a few years' time when we all have self-driving cars. But hopefully you all know what I mean. But very interesting. Okay. So, useful stuff this week, Scrivener 3 launches. Now, this is fascinating. This new Scrivener 3, which I haven't got yet because I love my Scrivener, but I will probably get this before I start my next book. I've now written 26 books on Scrivener and I love it. But one of the problems with the Scrivener I'm on, Scrivener 2, is the export, the compile option, which compiles the EPUB and the Kindle, and it didn't do a great job. And now the Scrivener 3 has new exporting CSS and styles and redesigned EPUB and improved Kindle export. So if you are a Scrivener user, you certainly like Scrivener for Windows, you might not need any other tool to do your exports. So although I'm a total fan of Vellum, maybe Scrivener will be able to do this. I actually like having different tools for different jobs. I think, you know, like best practice tools in each niche will always win. And Scrivener to me is best practice for writing. Vellum is best practice for formatting ebooks. Anyway, and of course, if you haven't checked out Vellum, my link is thecreativepen.com/Vellum, V-E-L-L-U-M. But yeah, Scrivener, awesome. So I will definitely be getting Scrivener 3, and they still have kept the price incredibly low. Thanks, Scrivener guys. Okay, so thanks for all your emails and tweets and comments this week. And remember to let me know what you're doing while you're listening to the show. Tweet me at The Creative Pen. Georgiana Daniels says, slogging through my workout while listening to the podcast. Thanks to you, I have a little extra pep in my step. Would you mind podcasting daily? Yes, I would mind. Thank you, Georgiana. But I'm glad it helps. And Diana L. Gunn says, really enjoying the first in-betweenisode from The Creative Pen, although it makes me kind of feel like a slacker. So thanks for that. And of course, the extra episode on Business for Authors went out this week. And Alison Sipe or Sip says, Christmas came early with your in-betweenisode. Made my day when I saw the notification. Thanks, Alison. And yeah, they're definitely not going to be every week, but I'm going to try and, add these in, especially because the interviews for the podcast are now scheduled like literally 6 months ahead. So there are things that I sometimes want to share and I don't have anywhere to share them, and they're longer than the intro. So I'm just going to embrace audio as kind of my superpower, the thing I most prefer doing and the way I most prefer to share. So expect more of those in 2018. Amber Janice says, 26 hours of driving in 1 week, plenty of time to make my way through all of the Creative Pen Q&A for Patreon supporters. Good investment. Wow, Amber, just listen to like 2 years of extra Q&A. I hope that was useful. Amy Kuivalainen, which is such a great name. I've probably murdered that. Sorry, Amy. It says, having a weird, I need validation as a writer because of frustration day to day. And she says, the only writer book that has ever done me good is The Successful Author Mindset. And thank you so much, Amy. I'm so pleased about that. And of course, remember, The Successful Author Mindset is available in audiobook, if that helps. Okay, and one more. David Nickel says, celebrating finishing my first NaNoWriMo with your podcast on a chilly walk to my co-working space in Trondheim in Norway. Fantastic. And Norway's on my list, David. I fully intend to come at some point. So thanks to everyone who emailed and tweeted and left comments on the show. I really appreciate it. And of course, I can't read them all, but I pick a few each week. And thanks so much to everyone. Thanks also because today's show is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life, and I'll play a word from our sponsor in a minute, which is exciting. And thanks to a new bumper crop of patrons. I'm going to assume that's either a Thanksgiving bump because you enjoy the show, or because people finally got around to listening to my really long episode. So thanks to Linda S. Gribko, Kelsey Conrad, James Allen, Rachel Devenish Ford, Terry Heath, Matt O'Connor, Eagles and Dragons Publishing, which is a fantastic imprint name, Vanessa Lilly, Nicole Hellyer, it's probably Hellyer, but Nicole, when I read it, I read Hellyer, which I think is a very cool name, Sal from Coffee Scale, which looks very nice for coffee addicts. Thanks to Holly Starkey for upping her pledge, and also to Rebecca Rickman and Kimberly Walton. Thank you, everybody. It's like a real bumper week for Patreon. I really, really appreciate your Patreon support, like your tweets and emails. It demonstrates you enjoy the show and want it to continue. And of course, on Patreon, just so you know, I charge for 2 episodes a month. So whatever you pledge, so say you pledge $1 per show, you only pay $2 a month. If you pledge $5 a show, you will pay $10 a month. So, and of course, you can choose how much you pledge, but I only charge twice. So even if I did the full 4 interview episodes, sometimes 5, depending on the month, and another 4 in-between episodes, so I might do 9 audios in a month, you would still only pay for 2. So I just wanted to be clear, with Patreon, I only ever charge those 2 per month. So yes, I will also, now we're in December, we're coming up to the next monthly Q&A, which I'll probably record before the Christmas season really hits, because I have a few Christmas parties going on. So get your questions in now if you are a Patreon supporter, and you can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, here's a word from Kobe Writing Life, and then we'll get into the interview.
Hey Creative Pen listeners, this is Christine Monroe from Kobo, and I am thrilled to tell you about the 2017 KWL Cover Contest happening right now at KoboWritingLife.com. After a heated debate and voting internally, we chose 30 of our favorite ebook covers from the year in three genres: romance, mystery thriller, and sci-fi fantasy. We've opened the contest up online, and the response has been awesome. Tons of votes, shares, and comments. And we're really excited to mention that Joanna's own latest release, Map of Shadows, is nominated. Have you voted yet? Go to KoboWritingLife.com right now to choose your favorite. On December 8th, we'll post the top finalists from each genre so you can vote for the overall winner. It was nearly impossible to narrow down the huge volume of amazing books that authors are publishing. These covers are stunning. Putting together the contest was a really exciting moment for our team to celebrate the incredible talent coming to Kobo Writing Life every single day. We are so proud to work with and support each of you. I'll hand it back to you, Joanna, and we have our fingers crossed for you and Map of Shadows.
Today, I'm here with ML Buckman. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
It's great to have you on the show. Just a little introduction. ML Buckman is the best-selling author of over 50 novels, including military romantic suspense, thrillers, and nonfiction for writers. He brings 30 years of project management experience into his author business. And today we're talking about estate planning for authors, which I have my copy of here. And Matt has
his.
Yes. Yay, there we are. We have matching. And this is an awesome book. Now, I have... this is one of those topics, you know, we could be talking about romance writing, but no, we're talking about estate planning because you bring a special angle. So Matt, start by telling us a bit more about you and how you got into writing and also into indie.
Well, oddly, I started writing while having a midlife crisis on wheels. I was going around the world on my bicycle. I had lost my business, my career, my house. And I said, screw it, and spent 18 months on the road on a bicycle.
Wait, how old were you at this point?
I was 35, so it's a little early, but I hit the curve. And and while I was out there, I started writing my first ever piece of nonfiction, or of fiction, rather. It started out as a little piece of nonfiction, a little vignette about a freshman roommate who killed alarm clocks, which turned into my first novel, which was awful. So I took a class and it ended up being my first sale. And so in 97, The Cookbook from Hell came out, a fantasy novel. And then I had one more release with them. Then I had my 10 years of rejections from traditional. And 2010, I started releasing indie. So I got in fairly early on it. And then I got a traditional contract. So, it went, you know, book that went through its standard 40 rejections, and finally somebody grabbed it and ended up being a 13 book series for the publisher, which were my Night Stalkers, Firehawks, and Delta Force. And that really found me my audience, which I then cemented with another 35, 45 indie books and 50 short stories. So I'm now 100% indie. But I had that nice boost from the 13 traditionals.
Yeah, wow. And that's great to hear that story, because so basically between the age of 35 and 2010, we would really say how many years that is. It's a few years.
It was 17 years.
Yeah. So basically you didn't write that much for that time.
Well, I lost 7 years of that to one book.
Right.
I had my magnum opus. My great book, it went through 9 complete revisions, over 1 million words, And let me tell you how useless a use of time that was, because how much more would I have learned if I'd written 10 books or 20 books instead of one book nine times? And it's a 180K book. So,
yeah. Wow. That's great to hear. Yeah. So just as a because Lindsay Broker said this as well, that she spent, I think, 7 years on her first book. And it seems like a common story. Johnny B. Truant, I think, same story, sort of, you know, all these years on one book. And it's the very literary fiction old model, I think. Well, not old model. Some people still do it. But for some, you know, we might get het up. But tell people what your production schedule has been like this year, 2017. Like, how have you shifted that completely?
Well, actually, it's shifting even more now, but I have a short story every single month, have for 4.5 years, that goes out for free on my website while it's for sale elsewhere. So it's free for 1 week on my website. And then on top of that, this last year, I did 8 novels and 4 collections. Going into next year, I'm actually going to do a short story and a novel every month.
Oh, you're doing the Dean Wesley Smith.
Yeah. So it's a 40K novel. It's a brand new series. It launches December 30th. And I'm just going to be doing a short story and a novel and just play in these worlds and just have fun. Mm. I want to focus more on the fun and on the writing. I've sort of gone down this channel of it's got to be important and I need to knock that out of my head. So I decided for a year, I'm just going to play.
That's great. I need to do that too. It's like, oh yeah, everything really has to have a meaning and be important. And like, yeah, I got to work so hard on
it. Not so much.
No, exactly. It's like the reader, especially at this point in history, just wants some escape. So we're going to come back. We're going to circle back to your romance writing as a guy, which is really cool. But let's get into the topic of estate planning. So first of all, why should authors care about estate planning? Isn't it all a bit morbid? And our books aren't worth that much anyway, are they?
Okay, how do I begin to answer this?
Why should we care?
Okay, books have a value of life, your life plus 70 years. That's the current standard copyright. There are some exceptions and twists, but basically, a copyright lasts for your life plus 70 years. So it has the ability to earn money for life plus 70 years. And the thing that a lot of people miss is a lot of that happens after you're dead. And it really can. And I have a number of examples that I put in the book, but it's the understanding that there is value there that people are missing. I mean, being a romance writer, okay, let's go back to Jane Austen and her 6 books. They went out of print a couple years after she died. Her family sat on them for a decade, and then a publisher came in and bought them for the equivalent of 250 copies. They bought all rights to all 6 books. They have not been out of print since.
And I live in Bath. I live in Bath, which is Jane Austenville, and it's full of Jane Austen merchandise. I mean, it's out of copyright now, but you know, at the time, it's crazy.
Yeah. And look at Prince. Here's this thing of immense value that he did no estate planning for. So they're spending millions upon millions of dollars just trying to figure out what the heck this is and where it goes and what does it belong to. So each of those people, if they had done reasonable estate planning, then the issues would have been much simpler and much cleaner. And that's actually where I got interested in the topic. I had my will in place and I made sure it was going to my kid and my wife in the way I wanted it to. But one day my kid happened to say she was scared to death about what happened the day I died. And it was like, why, you know, other than me being dead. And she said, because I have no idea what you've done or how to do anything with it. Mm-hmm. And that was the light bulb for me. So I turned to my wife and I said, but you could do it because she's my assistant. And she said, and it was like, okay, absolutely not. And so I started looking at what do I need to do to prepare my estate for them so that if something does happen to me tomorrow or 40 years from now, how the heck can they deal with it? What can they do with it? How do they make some sense of this legacy I've left behind, especially because I'm so prolific?
Yeah, and it's interesting because this is one of the issues of indie that has not been tackled yet. And your book, I think, I've had Catherine Goldman on and talked about this with Helen Sedgwick, who are lawyers. Mm-hmm. And you know, most traditionally published authors will have an agent. And many of the big agencies in London and Europe are made from dead author estates. And they literally do make money from those estates. And so it's so interesting you're saying this because you are 50 plus, you know, lots and lots of books already. And if you say you do live another 40 years, you might have an estate as big as Barbara Cartland, which was like, what, 600 romances,
right,
which her publisher is now making loads more money on. So let's just be very clear to people. This is not morbid. This is creating future wealth for your family, right?
Yes, that's the whole point, is not only for my wife and my kid, but her kids and maybe even their kids will have an active income coming out of my writing if it's handled well.
And is this
that's
like
part of what lit me up.
Yeah. Is this like a lofty and arrogant thing to be thinking about, do you think?
No, it's insanely practical because, I mean, I should have prefaced this whole thing. I'm not a lawyer though I did spend 9 years working in law. but it's a very complex thing that we do as indie publishers. Those of us who are really running our own businesses and running our own houses completely, it's a very complex thing we do. And to try to find a way to simplify that and make it practical so that our heirs know what their choices are and what the possibilities are, that was my challenge. Mm. And the thing about the agents, oh, God, it makes me crazy. There are whole estates that are disappearing from the face of the earth because they're being not handled by agents. They're being mishandled by agents. Had a friend who is an editor, Chris Rush, who was recently putting together an anthology of great women in science fiction. Mm. And she tried to get a short story of Octavia Butler. And this is all from the preface of her book, so I'm not giving anything away. And she went to the agent and she said, can I get a short story reprint right? And he proceeded to quote a novel price. And she said, no, this is just a short story reprint. So he doubled the price. And she argued some more and he doubled it again until it was more than the entire anthology was going budget. Octavia Butler, one of the greatest science fiction writers we've had, is disappearing from the realm because he's not interested in anything smaller than a movie deal. Mm. And that's only one of how many estates he has and how many agents are handling how many others. Some are doing a good job, but some are just murdering this estate or that estate. And I don't want that to happen to my estate. So I have to find a way outside of the agency model to have my estate managed and to have it continue on in some practical form.
Yeah. And it's interesting because as I say often, you know, I'm happily child free. So, you know, some people listening will have children, other people won't. And one of my heroes is Beatrix Potter in Britain, who spent her royalties on basically buying the Lake District, which she then gifted to the British people and is one of our protected areas. And that was done basically with an estate. And so this is important whether or not you have direct heirs or, you know, as I've, you know, got siblings and nieces and nephews and all of that type of thing. Parents, hopefully things will go in a natural way. But it's interesting. So let's then just dive into intellectual property a bit more, because I know the penny might not have dropped for some people listening, although I try and talk about this quite a lot. But when someone does a will, they would normally say, for example, in your case, if you die, I'm sure it's to your wife and then to your daughter. If your wife is dead, that would be a very obvious will. But the IP can be separate, can't it? Like you have a house, the house is very obvious, you know, but the IP can be quite different. So what are the ramifications of intellectual property as opposed to like physical property?
Well, there are three types of property, which are there's your personal property, there, which is your stuff. There's your real property, which is your land or house or whatever. And there's your intellectual property. And there's a reason they break these down and separate them in law. And the real trick to intellectual property is twofold. One is its value is unknown. At the time of your death, and this is actually a huge argument in the industry right now, how do you value IP after you're dead? At the moment of your death, the court wants to attach a price to it and put it so that they can tax it.
Yeah, inheritance tax. Yeah. This is basically
inheritance tax. Right. Mm. And how in the world do you structure that? That's not something I'm concerned about here. Though there are ways to mitigate that. But the challenge is that a house doesn't need much management, or it's a very practical thing to manage. If you have an apartment building, let's say you have a big estate of real property, you leave an apartment building, people know you hire a manager and you watch the manager or a property management company. What do you do if it's IP? The world is changing so fast. The Kindle anniversary was 10 years ago yesterday as we record this. And in 10 years, the entire shape of the industry has changed. Anyone want to predict 10 years out? Not me. You're welcome to try. I know you're into the future stuff.
I tried and we failed miserably. We went for 18 months, I think.
Yeah. But to nurse IP in that changing environment, it requires an active level of management. And it doesn't, one of the points I wanted to make is it doesn't have to be a grandiose estate. In 20, I think it was 15, Lucia Berlin had released a collection of her short stories called A Manual for Cleaning Women. Anyway, became a New York Times bestseller. Great. She had written 77 short stories during her life, put out three collections. This one collection blew the others out of the water, completely outsold her entire life's achievement. She'd been dead for 11 years. Mm-hmm. It was her heirs who went, oh, this is IP. It has value. 77 short stories. That's all it was. And how much money did it make her heirs, even in that single release, never mind the refreshing of the older IP that wasn't in that collection.
Mm. And it's funny you mentioned that, because I was talking to someone at the conference. We were both out on the Oregon coast, and I didn't realize that V.C. Andrews, whose Flowers in the Attic was like this iconic book, from many women listening be like, oh my goodness, Flowers in the Attic, that she was dead when we all were reading that. And it's been re-released now and she's still dead. And it's like, oh my goodness, I just thought she was alive. That's crazy.
Yeah. And we get audio rights and we get movie rights and we can get television rights with the massive expansion of television and streaming and pay per whatever. Mm. They're dying for IP. So they're mining existing IP and historic IP to create new TV shows and so on. That's a value that... How do I tell my heir how to manage this craziness? Mm. And so what I did was I said, okay, I wrote her a final letter. And that's the whole premise. That's actually the subtitle on the book, is Estate Planning for Authors, Your Final Letter and Why You Need to Write It Now. Mm. Because the idea is, okay, here's step one, a basic education in intellectual property. Step two, here are five different ways you can manage IP, from very involved to very uninvolved. But I know what those are already because I live in this industry. Mm-hmm. They don't have a clue. They're my heirs. You know, they are not involved in publishing. It's not what charges them up. It's what charges me up. Mm-hmm. And then I went through and I said, okay, now I need to organize everything so that when they take this object called Matt's IP, and they go to hand it off to somebody to manage and to take care of, that it's comprehensible. Because if you leave a mess, guess where it's going to end up? It's going to end up in the garbage can, and all that IP legacy dies with you. And all that I don't care about my legacy. I care about the fact that it's all future income for my family that they would effectively throw away because they don't know what it is. The heirs of Alan Drury went through Alan Drury wrote the 1960 New York Times number one bestseller, a Pulitzer Prize winner, and a major film. And then he wrote five sequels. And then he got really angry at New York Publishing and he told his executors to kill the estate. So after 15 years of poverty, his heirs managed to get the rights back from the executors. And they said, well, we could sell this. So they turned around. They were on the verge of selling the entire block of all six books for $3,000, all rights, because to them, that was all the value. That was a windfall. Well, somebody caught them and stopped them. And they now are making quite a bit of money from the re-release of these six books. And there's actually some noise about remaking the movie. And they had no idea what they had of the what was in the letter is here's what you have and here's some of the possibilities. And that's why I start the book out with why do I care? It's a whole big, long chapter on why do I care? And it's examples of things that were done right and done wrong.
Yeah, and it's a great guide. I haven't written my final letter yet, but I've sorted out my will, which is an important thing. And let's just be clear, the difference between a will and a final letter is the will is like the legal document, which doesn't have to be that long, and you usually do it with a lawyer or there are other ways. But it only contains like a couple of lines of who stuff goes to, whereas what you're saying, right. How long is your final letter?
14 pages.
Yeah. Okay. So that's not massive. It's not like a book, although presumably a copy of your book goes with it.
Yeah. And there's a copy of my final letter in here so that, you know, if you don't get around to it, hand this book to your heir and they'll go, oh, that's what that stuff is. So I tried to write it. So it's both get your act together. And here's a way that I found to get my act together. But it's also you're an heir and your IP creator didn't organize anything and didn't tell you anything. You can pick up this book and actually use it as a guide and an education tool to go, oh, that's what I have.
Exactly. And even for you, I mean, the number of authors I speak to, like I get emails all the time. Someone will say, my father published this book 10 years ago. Then he died. Do I have rights to the illustrations in the book? And I'm like, well, probably not, but have you got the contract? Or, you know, even the author themselves will say, well, I don't know if I own audio rights. And it's like, well, where's the contract? Like many people are like, yeah, haven't got a clue where it is. So even for like, you've been doing this a while, but there are people listening who might have been publishing since the 70s, for example, you know, who might have lots and lots of things. So this is a way to also collect what you have, right?
Yeah, I have. For example, one of the things I have, speaking of contracts, is I have a list of every single contract I have. And then I have a folder which has an electronic copy of every single contract. And then in the final letter, it says also in this drawer, in this filing cabinet, is a paper copy of every single contract. I don't expect my heir to be able to read any of it. I expect them to be able to pick up this file and turn to a publishing professional that they hire and go, here are all the contracts, and the publishing professional is going to go, oh my God, organization. Because normally what they get is, I think my dad published some stuff.
Yeah.
You know.
And I think this organization actually becomes more and more important. I mean, I have 26 books. I'm halfway to you at the moment, although you're much faster than me. So, but even with 26 books, I mean, even with each of the editions, you know, like I have large print as well as normal print, as well as workbooks, as well as all the ebook stuff, the audiobooks, and you sign various like audio contracts. Like it's nice to know when you can email ACX and get that back, or I got some German rights back, or, you know, knowing when these things stop. Also, a couple of other things I would say. One is get everything in print so that even if everything else fails, you've got a print book with your copyright in. Would you agree? I mean, you do that with your short stories too, don't you?
Absolutely. I have everything in print. And the idea is that it's sitting on my bookshelf. So if you need a guide to what I've got and you can't figure out anything else, it's sitting on my bookshelf.
And it, so it's not so much a vanity shelf as a, you know, this is what we have type of shelf.
Oh, no, no,
well.
It's a vanity shelf.
Oh, I was just trying to spin it.
No, it's totally a brag shelf.
Yeah.
But then what I also have is I also have a master file that I, and in the final letter, I say you need three master files, one of which is all of your passwords, one in whatever form you choose to store that and pass that on. One is everything about every title. And so actually in the book, and I don't know how well this will show up, I have a spreadsheet and it's multiple pages, but it's actually a single spreadsheet and I give it to you as part of the book. It's how to organize, how I organize every single title and all the information about it, including reversion rights. Did it get sold to Audio? Where's the contract? It's all line by line, every single title I've put out.
Yeah. And let's just remind everyone, you do have 30 years project management experience and you are on the very highly organized end of the spectrum. But, well, you know.
Yes and no. It all started because I lost a cover. And I started looking for this cover. And I went over there and I said, maybe it's in covers. No, maybe it's in science fiction. No, it's not with the story. Is it? And I, so what I finally did was I said, screw it. And I spent, it only took about 2 days to set up a folder structure, which I give you in the book, to here's how I organized everything and just dragging everything into a sensible form. And the sad joke was when I was all done, I still didn't have the cover.
But it is interesting because this will go out in December 2017. And it kind of, you know, a time when a lot of people start preparing for the new year. So organizing some of this stuff, even if it's in a number of stages. So I'm halfway to you, again, in number of books, but also in organization. You know, I've really started to organize. I run my business with my husband, like you with your wife. So he knows quite a lot. But I just want to say I use 1Password. So if people are looking for software, 1Password is pretty good. And then I've left my master password in the open in case of my death letter, and also backups. So for example, if you're listening and you haven't done anything else, like make sure you've backed up your computer, because it's still like you put everything in your computer folders and then you haven't backed up your computer. So I use Dropbox now. You know, we have hard backups, but you know what happened? I've been backing up to these hard disks, and then I got a new Mac. And I was like, oh, I know that's on that other disk that I took off and put, and then it wouldn't get sync with the new Mac because of some change in the operating system. So it's like having hard copies of everything is a, you know, a pain when you live how I do, which is more digitally. But these are all the things we need to think about, don't we, over time? And how much more of a nightmare will it be in another 10 years for us, like with the creation we do?
That, but I also think some of the technology, like 10 years ago, there wasn't a Dropbox.
Yes.
You know, so I think some of the technology is catching up with us, but I have the physical copy that's in my pocket all the time, everywhere I go. It's often, even in the evening, it will go in my bathrobe pocket. So it's physically on me. If there's a fire and I walk out the door, it's in my pocket.
That's your work in progress, is it?
This is everything.
Really? Wow.
Well, except the audio. The audio is too big.
Right.
But this is, you know, it's a 64 gig drive and it holds everything I've written.
It's very small. Covers. If you're listening on audio, it's one of those tiny looking things.
Yeah. It's a little USB drive.
Yeah.
I also do a weekly backup that goes off site. And it's not what I actually have 5 copies of that. So I make a copy and I move it off site and then I pull the 5-week old one back.
Yeah.
So if the apartment burns down when I'm not in it, I still have 5 copies out there in the world. In case one of them gets buggered, I've still got the 4 others. I'm losing as little as possible.
That's awesome. And also because we have print on demand books these days, we will, you know, presumably be able to get them. But again, still have the files because we don't know what will happen to these companies. And maybe people thought that in the 80s, like, you know, oh, I got a copy of my book and then they moved house and they lost it in a storage unit and blah, blah, blah. So I guess what we're just saying overall is try and think ahead a bit more and start getting organized. And the estate planning is sure, if you have a certain number of books, let's say, I mean, because someone who's just writing their first book has probably turned off this interview by now.
Probably.
but it is more for people who certainly have created more IP, isn't it? It's probably not too much to worry about if you've just got started.
Well, yes and no, because Alan Dury basically has 6 books.
Yeah, fair enough.
And
look at Harper Lee.
Harper, I was just about to say, quarter books.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. One in a first draft. Okay, so I did want to move on to just a couple more things. So let's just talk about the project management. And you and I have bonded over business stuff and organizing and planning and things. So because you meet a lot of indie authors, you go to NINC, you go to a lot of conferences, you do you have done the Oregon Coast one with Dean and Chris. What do you see that indie authors are doing wrong when it comes to business? Like, what do you go, oh, why don't you just do that about?
Oh my God.
Clearly a lot.
That's a whole nother hour. I would say the single biggest failing is they don't research business. We are, as indies, we are small business owners. And I have some indie author friends who are now mid-sized business owners because they've been so successful. And to think that you can run a business without understanding a return on investment, without understanding that business money and personal money actually can't mix once you get to a certain point, that by becoming a corporation at a certain stage of your career, you can save yourself an immense amount of taxes completely legally. It's just, There are things that have been built to help small business owners remain in business. And to not understand that they are in business, I think, is probably the single biggest failing. They go, oh, I'm just writing and making money. And yeah, no, you're not, actually. Because if you look at your advertising budget and your living budget, and you're actually digging yourself a hole, and you don't understand that your savings are going down without you even realizing it. You have to know where your money is. I'd say that's probably the true number one. You have to know what the money is doing at all times.
Yeah.
We look at our money every single day. It's the one thing we do every single day. We know how much is in which bank account. And if somebody is late paying us, that's our two basic things.
Yeah. I think that's really important. And I think, you know, we said this at the Oregon workshop, you know, I was like, if you're not doing your P&L, your profit and loss, you know, the difference between revenue and profit, I think, is a big problem in the indie author community. Like you say, it's like, oh, this money's coming in, but without working out what the expenses are and what's left at the bottom, which is the profit. And of course, we do spend like the first number of years being an author in loss because we're spending money on stuff. But then at some point it has to turn into profit, or it's not a business, or it's a business that is one of those whatever number of businesses go out of business in the first 5 years. So yeah, I think that's really good. There's so much we could talk about on business, but I then wanted to just before we finish, is your other side. So you're one of the few male your other side, because the talk, you know, what we've been talking about is your business side. You're a bit like me, I think. You know, I have Joanna Penn, which is my businessy side, and then I have JF Penn, which is my fiction side. You use the same name for both your fiction and nonfiction. But with your male, you know, you're being a male romance author, and you're open about your identity. Like, you, well, you're ML Buckman, so you could be a woman, but you tell us about being a man and a romance writer, and like your audio story. I want you to tell that.
It's been an interesting journey. It started in a funny way at my first ever conference. I got taken to RWA National, Romance Writers of America National Conference in 96. So we're talking about 1,800 women and 5 guys.
And your wife, and, I presume? No.
It was a very strange experience. And I actually read my first romance there. And I was raised on MGM musicals and Broadway shows. And so when I finally read one, it was like, oh, I get this. I understand this. And I actually, I'm a science fiction and fantasy writer at heart. And that's where I started. And it's what I read growing up continuously. And I made that transition over to romance literally at that conference. It just took me about 4 or 5 years to figure out how to, no, actually about 10 or 12 years to figure out how to write one. And I ended up selling, I didn't know quite if it was a thriller or a romance, and I ended up selling it to a romance house. And she said, well, this sounds like a thriller. I only buy romances. And I said, okay. She looked at me strangely. So we talked about it, and I revised it because I really wanted to make it a romance. And in the process of doing that, she ended up buying the whole series. But in the process of doing that, we discussed my being male. And she said, well, I'm not sure that the current market is ready for a male author in straight romance. Now, since then, there's been a huge emergence of male authors writing male-male romance. Hmm. But I write hetero romance. And so we decided to use ML, and my first bios were gender neutral. Mm-hmm. My website, if you went to it and looked it about, then you'd get my picture. But my picture is nowhere in my books. And what I get less now, but I got a lot in the beginning, was I never would have picked up your book if I thought you were male. I'm so glad I did. Mm-hmm. And I've got a huge number of fans who've given me that exact email. And they've now died off from twice a week to maybe once a month. But so there's more acceptance of me as a male writer. What I bring to it that I feel is lacking in a lot of romance is, for me, I'm writing about the women. I'm writing about strong, it's in my byline, strong women and the men they deserve. And so I'm writing about these magnificent women and the men they deserve. And my readers, and I've asked them, and they're reading it the other way around. It's like they get to slip into these powerful women and they get the right man. So it's not that the woman plays a secondary role or anything, that these people then go, oh, you know, yeah, I can pretend this because I get the guy. It's like, no, you get to feel powerful at the same time. And I think that's one of the keys to my success. Mm. And it's the message that I want to write. It's the world I wish my wife had grown up in and the world I hope my daughter grows up in, where strong women are something to be admired and sought after.
Oh, you're lovely. I like everyone's swooning. Everyone's like, oh, I love you, Matt.
It's just, it's always been there. I came from a matriarchy. Hmm. And it's multi-generational. And it's often, I've often said my mom's one mistake was marrying a strong man. Because strange household. But my sister more than made up for it. I mean, she's just a powerful woman. She's just awesome.
Oh, that's lovely. Well, as a strong woman, I definitely needed my strong man. So, you know, but coming back to the gender thing, it's so funny because I use JF Pen because when I wrote my first two thrillers under Joanna Pen, and someone left a review on Amazon or somewhere that said, you know, I'm so surprised that a woman could write this. And I was just like, okay, what is this?
I know.
What is going on here? So it's so interesting. And now it's interesting because a lot of people use initials and they can be either way. You know, it's great. I think it's brilliant that you're in romance. So I did want to just come, sorry, carry on.
Oh, there's just one more piece to that, which is to me, it felt really appropriate because the way women used to hide in phone books was by only putting their initials, which of course told you it was a woman trying to hide in the phone book. And so it's like turnabout is fair play. And so here I am, this male writing in romance. And it's like, okay, I'm going to pretend to hide by doing this kind of open pen name of ML Buckman.
Which is awesome. But just tell your audiobook story, like why you read your own audiobooks.
Well, I have this voice. And so I figure that if I'm going to read to you about a night stalker and a Black Hawk helicopter and a woman who can fly it, I might as well use this voice. So my theory was somebody, you know, gets to listen. I didn't know I had a voice like that till I was courting my wife. And she said, oh, my God, you have a wonderful phone voice. I was like, really? Oops, blew that cover.
Well, I think that's fantastic. And I mean, it's so interesting. Do you think just on the romance, I'm not really aware because I haven't done audio for my sweet romance yet. But is it more common to have male narrators or female narrators? Do your audience, do you know?
It's still more common to have female, but it's by no means stamped one way or the other. But it is far more common to have a female narrator.
And you probably stand out more because of that, which is kind of awesome. I did just want to kind of ask about the futurist stuff, because you and I both like futurist stuff. And also you are so on the cutting edge of what the romance writers are doing, which is generally futurist for anyone else listening. And you go to NINC and you go to all these conferences. So, and for example, you know, romance writers did eBooks before everyone else. They did Facebook ads before anyone even heard about it. They did Amazon ads. They do everything. So what are romance writers doing either now or next year that most indies like won't even have heard of yet? Or what's exciting you about what's going on in the market or anything that you're excited about?
Well, I have to say the main thing the romance writers seem to be doing at the moment is asking each other what's next. they're kind of, we're waiting for what the next thing is. And I talked to a lot of them and they're kind of going, yeah, one more person tells me how to do Facebook ads, I'm going to shoot them. But what's next? And for me, and what the thing that really shook NINC this year was BookFunnel's announcement of we're going to aid you in direct delivery. And at this point, if you sell directly from your site, you can then embed a link that BookFunnel will fulfill the delivery of the ebook for you. Mm. Oh my God. Because I look at the trend of the industry and it used to be as a writer that we sold to the gatekeeper. So you could, the whole thing, it was a single path. How do you get past the agent, the editor, and into print? It was all about that. Now, indie, we get direct to the reader. Except we don't. We're going through Amazon and Kobo and Barnes & Noble, bless them all. But the direct access to the reader, where we're completely bypassing the systems and we're building such a clear brand that the reader finds us, I think that's where the future is. So now the question that I'm asking and I'm asking of other people is, how do we take that brand and maintain discoverability? Because right now our discoverability engines are Facebook ads and Amazon and so on. When we start doing direct sales and direct connection and direct relationship, how do we become discoverable to a wider audience as we continue to grow? Yeah. And that's the nut I'm looking at for myself.
Yeah. But
I think direct is the next step.
Fantastic. I'm so glad you say that, because of course, you know, I've been doing direct sales for a number of years now, for my nonfiction mainly. And I think, as you say, the problem is getting traffic to a fiction website, which you're solving a bit with your free short story every week. And I'm starting to solve by doing content that my JF Pen readers will enjoy. And that's basically, the Creative Pen has been built on Google search based on content. So content marketing kind of comes back into play. But it is so interesting. And by the time this airs, I've got one book with the new book funnel delivery, but we're just building all the rest of them. So, because, you know, now I have all these books I have to build. So do you, right? It's quite a bit of work to kind of
I have about 150 titles when you look at all the collections and everything. It's getting daunting to add a channel.
Exactly. Yeah.
I want to add that channel.
Definitely. Or maybe add it for, you know, your box sets first, or something that will, you know, the short stories are like, you know, slightly, you know, would maybe sell less, or I don't know. But it's so interesting how this is the next thing. And I agree with you. I think and would you say also that the income for many authors in the niche has settled or gone down or been affected, so that they are looking at other ways?
I say yes and no. And the reason is some people's income is doing this and some are doing this.
Going up or down for the audio listeners.
Oh, sorry. Yes. waving my hands in the air meaninglessly for the audio people. But the ones who are moving up, what they seem to have in common is they're focusing on readers. They're focusing on content delivery. That's one of the reasons I'm trying my novel every month is because, well, I have a pet theory called the reader clock, which if we have a moment, I'll get into. Amazon is big data. So they actually, and they've said this, they reward us if we have a release every 30 days. Doesn't have to be big. It can be a short story or a collection or something, but it's ticking the clock and their algorithm will actually reward you if you do something every 30 days, rank you a little higher, make you a little more visible. Well, they're big data. So where did they learn that? And they learned it by watching readers. And the readers, who are the ones I want to connect to directly, are eager for more. So Written Word Media, who owns Bargain Booksy and Free Booksy and a couple of others, did a survey of their readers and said, how often do you want a newsletter from your authors? And they said a minimum of once every 4 weeks, a maximum of twice a week. And that number made my head hurt until I started thinking about the Amazon algorithm that said 30 days. And a reader, your average reader, probably doesn't have 18 different book groups that they belong to because they're trying to learn about the industry and, you know, 300 people hitting their inbox every day. And so when an author shows up, they go, oh, ooh, something new to read. So I'm looking at what can I do to deliver content on a slightly faster schedule and also on a more consistent schedule, trying to hit and understand that reader clock. And so this year is an experiment of I've been doing that short story on the 14th of every month for 4.5 years, and I don't see it stopping anytime soon. It's too much fun. But also by adding a novel that's going to be on the 30th. Of every month and see if I can maintain that. If not, then I'll just say it's on the 5th, but trying to do something regular like that for the reader. And it's my way to test how happy that makes the reader.
Yeah.
As well as making me happy, the writer, because we talked earlier about, you know, the business brain and the personal brain, you got to keep those separate. And I think that's one of the big problems writers have when they move into being successful is they start letting the business into their writer space. No, my writer gets to sit over here and have fun. And I say, I want a novel a month, but keep them short. And my writer goes, okay, I can do that. And then I take them out of the writer's hands and I market them on my test of the reader clock. So I keep those. I actually have another book on that called Managing Your Inner Writer about split brain thinking and how to keep those two apart. But I think that's really important, going back to part of our earlier conversation.
Fantastic. I think that ticking the reader clock really resonated with me when I heard you talk about that in Oregon. And, you know, I want to do that next year. And I'm a slower writer than you. And many people listening, in fact, most people listening will be a slower writer than you. And but I think the short story a month, or even I suppose if you have a novel and then a short story and then maybe a box set and then another short story. And, you know, there are ways to do things, right?
It doesn't even have to be that. I was talking to somebody who's working the reader clock very successfully, but what she's doing it with 3 novels a year.
Okay.
And the way she's doing it, though, is she starts out with covers coming. Here's a cover reveal. Here's an opening scene. Here's a piece of research on a weekly release.
Okay.
And she has a 12-week buildup to the release of the novel. And then she has a 12-week taper out. Here's a bonus scene. Here's another odd fact of how it relates to something that I wrote earlier. Here's another teaser. So she actually has a 6-month cycle that she uses every 4 months. As one is running down, the next one starts running up. So she's always in the reader's mind once a week, regular as clockwork. She's hitting the same day every week, and she's hitting the same three spots for release every year. So I don't remember her cycle, but if June 1 is one of her releases, there will always be a June 1 release. And she's making upper six figures on three novels a year. But she's being really intelligent about working with the reader.
Yeah, and planning. Oh, and I see. So you're separating the reader clock from the Amazon algorithm clock. So the 30-day clock, if you can hit it on Amazon, but otherwise the reader clock can be an email with a piece of extra content or something like that, which is...
Content.
Yeah, which is fantastic. And I could definitely do that. And I'm thinking a lot about this for JF Penn next year. But that habit, like this podcast really took off when I went weekly on a Monday. And until you become a habit, it's like quite sporadic, isn't it? So I really get that. And it's also proof of all the people like yourself who put out books regularly, you know, are doing better. So that's fantastic. You and I could talk forever, but we need to finish. So tell people where they can find you and your books online.
M.L. Buchman, that's B-U-C-H-M-A-N, that's .com, that's on Facebook, that's on Twitter, that's on Google. It's all M.L. Buchman. So easy to find.
And the book, Estate Planning for Authors, and all your romance and everything else will be there and on all the usual stores. So thanks so much for your time, Matt. That was great.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So I hope you enjoyed the interview with M.L. Buchman, and make sure you get your will and any power of attorney you need and your last letter sorted for 2018. And remember, your creative intellectual property rights have value. Yes, you actually have an estate. It's amazing. Now, you might not be feeling that now, but I hope some of our words for today, from today, go into your minds, and some of you might think about that in future. Okay, coming up next week, I have an interview with Andy Bromley and Ruth Jones from Ingram Spark, and we're talking about how to sell more books in print and how you can use Aereo, a new online tool to set up your own bookstore to sell other people's books and receive the bookseller cut. Now, this is awesome because it means we basically can all be booksellers of other people's work too. And print has definitely been a big expansion for me in 2017, and I will be continuing that in 2018. Okay, so happy writing week, and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.